Welcome to Local Talk Wednesday on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in our seven-county listening area in central Iowa. Thank you for listening in. I am one of your hosts for today, Susan Franzen, together with my co-host, Paul Wearson. It's great to have you back, Paul.
Well, it's great to be back. We had a little bit of a viral infection. I lost my voice. Then the cold weather came in. It was below zero. And finally, I'm off the cabin and off the farm. And today, we had to drive in a little below zero. I hate to start the old Buick, because it's kind of like asking your grandfather to run the 100-yard dash. But it started. Here I am at the studio. I'm back.
Well, I'm glad you're feeling active, because our program today is about a lot of ways to get out and do something, from voting to lobbying to having a good time. First, we'll have your interview with Matt Patton, superintendent of the Roland Story Schools, giving us information about the bond issue for the new high school auditorium and football stadium. Following that, we'll have three stories dealing with the 1950s, one from Boone and two from Nevada, and a report from Pat Schlarbaum on the fourth in a series of water quality forums throughout the state.
Well, I'm happy to start with the whole idea of voting on a bond issue. And in Story City and Roland, there's an important bond issue coming up, I believe, on February 6th. And we have Matt Patton, the superintendent of the Roland Story School District, waiting to tell us about it. Good morning, Matt.
Good morning, Paul and Susan.
Well, we're glad to have you with us, and you have a very big event coming up. Am I right? Is it on the February 6th date?
You do have the date correct.
Good.
Polls are open from noon to 8 o'clock in both Roland and Story City on February 6th.
Well, that's a big day in the life of the school district. And I guess when you talk about a bond issue, the first thing you need to talk about is need. And give us a little background on why, especially the football stadium, is an issue.
Yeah, we've got a couple projects in this bond for consideration by the public. The first is a renovation of the high school auditorium. That facility has been in place for about 25 years and just needs some refreshing and updating, specifically some new lights and new sound and video capability and just, you know, refreshing that space. The second project that we're considering on February 6th is building of a new football marching band track complex, specifically planning to put that at the Outlet Mall location. And yeah, there are specific needs for each of these projects. The renovation of the high school auditorium, I'll start with that. You know, we just, after 25 years, the technology has advanced so far. You know, I'm guessing that most people aren't using the same cell phone or the same phone that they were using 25 years ago. Things have progressed, and most people have cell phones now. Same thing has happened in that space. The technology has advanced to LED lights that allow us to use thousands of colors that are much cooler to the participants on the stage. The curtains have advanced to be more fire retardant, and they're safer in that regard. We are bumping up on a deadline for the FCC to kind of take away some of our sound capabilities in the form of wireless microphones, so we need to upgrade our sound system as well. And then obviously when they installed that, we didn't have the video capability that we have today. And so putting some cameras in that space that would allow for, you know, patrons to step out of the auditorium and still be able to view what's happening on stage from the commons outside the auditorium, and then also for our participants who are going to be on stage in just a few minutes to view what's happening on stage backstage through video capability. So that's part of the need that's associated with the auditorium. The football complex is probably the bigger of the two projects, obviously, and you know, there's several things that we're very concerned about at our current facility, primarily things like handicap accessibility. Making sure that the people who have a difficult time getting around or getting to our events have it easier. We don't have access at our facility now to, you know, to be able to both view the game from a good vantage point and then also have access to things like restrooms and concession stands. And so you sort of have to make a choice when you come to our games, if you're in a wheelchair or on crutches, whether you want to see the game from a good viewpoint or want to have access to restrooms and you know, the concession stand. And we don't think that's right, and we think that we ought to be able to provide for all of our community and especially those that may have a difficult time getting around. Another big part of this is just safety around the facility. If you've ever been to our current football field, the parking is a challenge. In most cases, you have to park at least a half a block away, and many people are parking a block and even two and three blocks away and then crossing busy streets to get to our gate, our admission gate. And so a new facility would allow us to overcome that with some adequate parking on site and make things obviously more handicap accessible. The other thing that is a challenge at our current field is just having enough restroom space. We are significantly below code requirements for restrooms at our current facility and think that we need to provide a better facility for both our fans and also our athletes who currently don't have a locker room at the field. And so during halftime, obviously, that's a challenging time. Coaches want to talk to kids. It's a very short time. Our kids who need to use the restroom during halftime that are participating on the field need to run up to the school, which is about a block away, and use the facilities up there, and so that creates a challenge. The stadium seating is really insufficient for the crowds that we are currently getting at our games, and so we feel like if you paid $5 to get in the game and you want to have a seat, we ought to be able to provide one for you, and currently we can't do that for all of our fans. And we're landlocked at our current location, so if we wanted to expand things like parking or provide for locker rooms and those types of things, it would be a challenge. I'm going to tell you that we're probably not able to do those things at our current site, not only because we're landlocked, but because it floods on a pretty regular basis. It's flooded. Our whole entire football field's in a floodplain, and it's flooded 8 times in the last 9 years. And you can imagine the damage that does to things like the track and the playing surface of the football field. It obviously creates problems. We've had to cancel at least one varsity football game and several lower-level games over the years to accommodate for flooding concerns. The other issue that we have there is irrigation. So in some years when it's too wet, we flood, and in other years when it's too dry, we have a very difficult time growing nice thick grass for our players. We do have an irrigation system at the field, but the water pressure that's associated with it, it comes off of an old well that we share with the golf course, is really insufficient to just simply cover the whole field surface. So, you know, we have challenges in both wet years and dry years. That probably highlights the majority of the things that are issues at the current football field, but all those things could be overcome by relocating to a new facility.
Now, Matt, this facility would be right out by the interstate highway, and for those of you who've driven by that area for years, you're aware that the outlet mall that was there and still is there now, which is now really an empty building and a vast empty parking lot, that's the chosen site for the field. Is that right, Matt?
That's correct.
And so that will be right by the interstate highway, and it'll be some distance from the school. Is that going to be a problem?
Yeah, we think that site actually provides a great front door into our communities. We think that getting rid of what many people have described to me as an eyesore in a dilapidated mall and putting something there that is positive and really helps sell our community is a benefit to not only the school district but to the community. We are moving then the football field further away from our high school. We don't believe that that will present significant challenges for us. It's really about a mile to that new site. We will still continue to practice our football practices at our current field, so we won't have to travel that distance for football practices. Our track coaches tell me that they need to do a mile jog for a warm-up each practice, so we've talked to them, and they anticipate they would probably just jog out to the new field as part of their warm-up. There will be a few times when we're going to have to bus some people or some things. Certainly marching band equipment might need to be put in our enclosed trailer and moved out there so that those kids could have their equipment when it comes time to march on the field and things. But for the most part, I don't think it'll create a significant additional transportation need for us.
So I'm just wanting to know, when you're in your perception right now, do you feel this is going to be a controversial issue, or are you pretty confident that it'll be passed?
Well, I'm confident in the people of Roland and Story City. If you look back historically, when there's been needs for our kids in the school, they've stepped up consistently. If there's needs in the community, like getting rid of a dilapidated property, you know, we have high expectations here, and I don't think our citizens are going to want to have the mall sit there vacant and be an eyesore to the community for many years to come. And so I'm confident in the people here to step up and provide the things that we need as a school district. There's no doubt that there are people who are concerned that maybe it's not the right location, or maybe that it will increase taxes beyond what they're comfortable. But overall, I feel pretty good about the project.
Well, that bond issue is coming up on February 3rd. And that's
February 6th, actually.
You know, I said that, Matt. My birthday is February 3rd. So,
well, happy birthday early.
Yeah, well, I'll be 75, so I've got 3/4 of a century under my belt now.
Congratulations.
So February 6th is a bond issue, and they'll be voting on not only improvements to the auditorium at Roland Story School, but also a brand-new track and football facility out by the Interstate Highway, now occupied by the old outlet mall out there, which is vacant and has been for some time. And so that would be a brand-new use for that piece of ground. And so, Matt, I know you've had a good information campaign out there and presented a lot of public meetings and presentations. Have you had a lot of questions about this, and do you see some opposition there from some folks at those meetings?
Yeah, there's certainly not 100% support for these things, and you know, probably the first question that people ask is, you know, how is this going to impact my taxes? And so in those presentations, we try and share with the public the fact that Roland Story's school tax rate is considerably lower than most of the school districts around us. And so it's an advantage to live in the Roland Story school district if you want to pay less taxes, because the tax rate is just simply lower. And we have continued to lower our tax rate as a school district over several years. And even with the passage of this bond vote and a slight increase in taxes, we'll still have a lower tax rate here than we had just 6 years ago in 2012. So we feel good about those things. The average homeowner in Roland and Story City will see about a $10 increase in their monthly taxes. Obviously, that's through property taxes. And so, you know, for some people who are on fixed incomes, that sounds like a lot of money, and that can be a challenge to provide that additional $10. And for many others, they see that as, you know, a trip to McDonald's or a couple coffees in the morning. And so to them, they don't see it as such a big deal. So it all depends on your perspective. But, you know, we feel that it's a good project worth considering, and the tax implications were something that the public ought to get to vote on.
Well, I think you've been very complete in what you presented today, Matt, and I'm sure you've had that same experience one-on-one and in meetings where you presented this whole idea. And there's been plenty of opportunity for voter input, and any kind of questions can be answered and have been answered at these meetings. And so we depend on people to go out and vote intelligently about this. And that's true of every school district. I know that, you know, this local talk program we do on Wednesday is really involved with surrounding communities. And we're very in touch with what's happening at all the community school districts in Story County. And there's always an issue about upgrades and maintenance. And certainly for someone who's older like me, it's all sticker shock on what it costs. So
yep.
Basically, you know, everyone, when you propose a bond issue, there's a real sales issue there that you have to do in terms of just straight out information, particularly, as you mentioned, about taxes. And I think that the school district has a pretty good record of supporting bond issues in the past. And I know a lot of older people in Story City who have a real history of voting for school bond issues and improvements, even though their children have long ago grown up. And so I feel that a lot of Story City people who are, quote, elderly, have been pretty supportive of the school district and pretty able to think outside their own family and for the future. So, Matt, thank you very much for being with us today. Good luck. February 6th is the voting. What time do the polls open, Matt?
Polls open at noon. They close at 8 p.m. Absentee ballots are available now, so if people wanted to vote early, they certainly could.
Good. Well, thank you, Matt Patton, Superintendent of Schools, Roland Story, a man very well respected, by the way, by the staff and teachers. I live in that district, and Matt's a popular guy. So thank you, Matt.
Thanks, Paul. I appreciate the time this morning.
All right. Thank you.
In case you just tuned in, this is KHOI Community Radio with your hosts Susan Franzen and Paul Wearson. Paul has been talking with Matt Patton, superintendent of the Roland Story Schools, giving us information about the bond issue for the new high school auditorium and football stadium, which will come up for a vote February 6th.
Our next story is also something I'm concerned about. The fate of the Mamie Dowd Eisenhower House in Boone.
A lot of people have been asking me when we're going to do an update on that. So I was delighted when Pat Schlarbaum contacted the director of the Boone County Historical Society, Mara McKay, to let our listeners know that there is something they can do about it if they are members of the society.
But I'll tell you that my visit to the Mamie Dowd Eisenhower birth site in Boone was very rewarding. They've done a good job. They've got a lot of family pieces there, and they've got an excellent presentation, and everything is dated about the time that she was growing up, taking piano lessons and all this sort of thing. And in the back, there's a little garage, and someone, I don't know who, gave Mamie this old Valiant, white Valiant, a brand new car. Looks like it's hardly been used. And it's parked in the garage behind the building. And it's such a quaint little white Valiant from the old American Motors Company that was given to Mamie as a gift. And when you get into the Mamie Dowd Eisenhower Library there, it's just a nice trip back, and it's very well cared for. But I know there are issues about maintenance and who is going to provide the sustenance and money and support to keep that open. And there are issues around what organization can do that. And the Boone Historical Society, that seems kind of like a natural for me for them to be involved with that. So I really hope that whatever happens in Boone, this wonderful little birthplace is preserved because it's beautiful, quaint, and well done.
Well, I think I can probably get
it
the...
Very nicely presented.
Well, maybe we've got that video
audio.
And
good morning.
You work for the Boone County Historical Society?
That's correct.
Are you from Ames or Boone? You're from this area?
I actually live in Ames, and I drive over to Boone. My kids go to Gilbert, and I enjoy both communities. Mm-hmm. They both have a lot to offer. I think we're lucky to have Ames surrounded by small rural communities, and I think Boone and small rural communities are lucky to have Ames.
You have some facilities.
Our main facility on Story Street is a four-story former Masonic temple, and it is incredibly magnificent when you walk in. The beams are stunning. The architecture in the building is spectacular. It is coming together around a building improvements project right now, so some of the floors have been restored, and they are just incredibly appealing. It's just a very nice feeling when you walk through the front door of the Boone History Center on the corner of Story Street there on 6th Street.
So 602 Story Street.
602 Story Street. Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. And Boone has a very rich railroad.
Yes, they do. It's fabulous. It's been built around the railroad, and then early mining was also influential. The galleries within the Boone History Center articulate some of those early Boone histories. We've been working with Humanities Iowa on a project. They're a partner of ours so that we can develop the early Boone history and tell that story along with many other stories and exhibits in that museum.
And our listeners are familiar with the Kate Shelley.
Yes, and Kate Shelley was actually the first facility that the Boone County Historical Society operated, supported, and managed. So that's out in Mongona. It's near Seven Oaks, and you drive into Mongona.
Yeah, south of Boone, mm-hmm. but on the on the west bank of the Des Moines River.
That's correct. Uh-huh. Yes. And people love to walk down. Classes come down and they will tour the Kate Shelley facility, oftentimes going then most excited to see the abutments that are still on the river. So taking a trail hike about a mile down.
Yeah, where Kate Shelley saved the train.
Yeah.
And is there any sort of country school?
Yeah, there is the Hickory Grove Country School. It's on your way into Ogden. It is a very nicely preserved country school. It's a partnership with Batten Chapel Association. And the Batten Chapel Association primarily takes care of that facility. However, we like to support them through giving them our collection, supporting them with mini grants, just any kind of grant partnering that we can do to help the Hickory Grove Country School.
And they're and right marketing. On Mamie Eisenhower Road or Old 30.
The Old 30.
East of Ogden. Mm-hmm. And how about one of your former first ladies, Mamie Dowd Eisenhower?
Yes, we have the Mamie Dowd Eisenhower birthplace, which is located at 709 Carroll Street. And it is a charming Victorian home with beautiful restorations inside and stunning green space. It's a spectacular green space for events potentially. So right now we're looking at different ways that we can utilize that facility.
What's the address?
The address is 709 Carroll Street, and it's a little Victorian, kind of a off to the side on the lot, yellow home, just a really remarkable historic facility.
And when you mentioned refurbishment, another word for maintenance and dollars.
Yeah, it is. And we have really struggled ever since the facility was moved from across the street over to the location where it is now. We have had a lot of maintenance to any old historic structure will, but keeping this going and trying to balance the ticket sales with the maintenance, it's never really broken even for many, many, many years. And the first couple of years did very well, but we've always struggled with revenue. And at this point, after 37 years as a museum exclusively, the Boone County Historical Society Board decided that they needed to explore other options and evaluate possible ways that they could bring in more revenue. One of those ways has been a vacation rental, not necessarily a bed and breakfast where someone would cook for you, but rather you would come in and get to stay there and engage with the history in a different way.
Oh, wow. That sounds unique and wonderful.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
If people wanted to become members of the Boone County Historical Society, is there a website?
Yes, there is a website. It's boonehistorymuseums.org. Boone History Museums, museums plural, .org, and you can go check that out. You can contact us by phone, 432-1907. You can come over and visit us at the Boone History Center across from the Dutch Oven from 10 to 4, Tuesday through Friday, and on Saturdays 10 to 1. So those are the main ways that you can reach out to us.
What's going to happen January 25th?
Yes, well, It's kind of unique right now. It's a transitional time, I think you would say. And I think for those that love history, for those that want to preserve structures like the Mamie Dowd Eisenhower, like the Boone History Center, if you have an interest and you are thinking, I would love to see this grow, I would love to see this flourish as an attraction, we encourage you to become a member and then come to the meeting on the 25th. And help us to move forward with new bylaws and to also vote for new board members, because we have a lot of younger people that are getting involved. One of those is just a recent DMAC graduate. He's a nurse that works at Mary Greeley, and he's coming on board, so you'd be voting for him. And then
his
name is Nathan Lake, so he'll be one of the on-the-ballot board members that'll be there. And we have a number of other people that have been interested in getting involved, and we'd like more people to participate. We'd like to have people understand what we're trying to do and then help us move those things forward.
Well, is there anything else? Mary McKay, this sounds like a wonderful opportunity to contribute. Why do museums need our membership and support?
Yeah, well, it's a changing industry. It has been for many years in decline. I think museums have struggled primarily because there is a lot of competition in this day and age for attractions among tourism sites. And with declining support from the federal government, from state governments, we often struggle to pay those bills, to keep the lights on. But there are three different costs when you run a museum. It's indirect, direct, and preservation. So you have to take care of all of those facets in order to keep a historical site moving and vibrant and filled with good programming and all of those things. So I think there's definitely been a challenge among historic sites and museums in particular to keep the doors open and to keep their programs active and engaging for people. And you really have to continue to listen to the people and develop. And when I say listen to the people, it's all of the people of all ages, because there is a new phone society out there, a monitor society that, you know, back 30 years ago, there wasn't as much for kids to do going into a facility like the Mamie Dowd Eisenhower or a museum of any kind was very amusing. But now when you're competing with a phone or a monitor, you often have to update or upgrade or try to engage students. And it's not for everyone. There are a lot of people that still love to go back and remember. But if we don't have membership support, we can't accommodate the shortfalls in our budget when we don't have visitors, or to maintain the property when we, say, have a major repair that has to take place. On the Mamie Dowd Eisenhower birthplace, we have a number of repairs that haven't been kept up with, and we need to find ways to address those through our partners, through our members, through our grant agencies that we seek to build partnerships with. There's a lot of factors involved.
And I think I've heard it said recently, if we didn't have a museum of the quality at 602
yes.
Story Street, we sure wish we did.
Yes, that is such a wonderful statement. I'm so glad a caller or someone said that to you, because that facility in central Iowa, it's remarkable. We have the Octagon, which is a former Masonic temple. And I think that those kinds of structures, like the Boone History Center, which is a remarkable, incredible facility built in 1907 by the Masons. It was named the Frank Chaplin Memorial Temple, and it's just, it's something to see. It's something that you're not going to see forever, and many of those structures have been lost to time and taken out of our cities and our communities. But to hang on to those treasures, really vital.
So Mara McKay's message with the Boone County Historical Society: become members, and then members need to appear and vote January 25th. Support the relevancy
Absolutely.
Of our local treasures,
mm-hmm.
and of
yes.
which you speak very well, very highly.
Well,
and thank you for
you.
All
mm-hmm.
that you bring to the Central Iowa community
and
our listeners of KHOY.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Uh-huh.
This is KHOY Community Radio, Story City, Ames, and surrounding area. I'm one of your co-hosts today, Paul Wearson, together with my co-host, Susan Franson.
The focus on the Eisenhowers, who occupied the White House for 8 of the 10 years of the 1950s, is a great teaser for our next story about the lead-off program taking place at the Nevada Public Library on Monday, January 22nd at 7 p.m., A Look Back, the 1950s, subtitled The Idyllic Post-World War II Decade, Baby Boomers, Rock and Roll, Values, Politics, and the Societal Changes That Still Have an Impact Today. I went over to Nevada last week to talk with Shauna Speer, the new director of the library, and Jean Freestad, who will be starting the new series, Breaking the Ice, which begins with the 50s.
I am here because I read about a very interesting sounding program that you're beginning this month called Breaking the Ice. Is that what you're doing?
Yes, I am. I came up with this as an original programming concept to bring people into the library and foster interest in the library and provide interesting discussion and education opportunities for the community.
And I presume that the ice that you're breaking doesn't have anything to do with the weather?
No, it is mental ice rather than physical ice.
The first one is on the 50s, is that right?
Yes, that's correct. It is on January 22nd at 7 p.m. and we're going to have an hour-long presentation on the 1950s. It will include the values, the popular culture, touching on the politics of the time, other interesting things, the music, the stars of the day. If I can fit it in, I'll get an old-fashioned TV clip in there. But we're going to take a little tour through the 1950s and see what happens.
As someone who remembers the 1950s, I was wondering if you had any space in there for people who want to reminisce.
Well, we would like that. If I am very succinct in my presentation, there will certainly be time for discussion and reminiscing. I think it's going to be a fun time. The Breaking the Ice series is not meant to degenerate into divisive arguments. It's meant to be a more light touch on some of these subjects, but yet be fact-based and be clear and coherent and make people think just a little bit about the different subjects that we go through during the year. Every month, the subject matter changes. It's not all historical. The Breaking the Ice series does not have an overarching theme because we want to appeal to different groups of people every month. And certainly there will be some people that come every month, but we want to bring interest to people that maybe wouldn't necessarily come to the library, but they may see a subject matter that they do want to participate in and listen to. So it's kind of an eclectic sort of mix of subject matter.
Well, I remember growing up in the 50s that there was an atmosphere of fear. At the time, I didn't understand it. We were called the Silent Generation. And it was so different than what followed in the 60s. It was like the lid came off. They opened all the windows. And suddenly, people weren't silent anymore.
It's true. It's very true. In the 50s, you know, you were straight out of the World War II, and, you know, everybody was stiff upper lip and, you know, just stay quiet and toe the line and do what you're supposed to do. And in the 60s, everybody was sick of that. And they decided that, no, we're going to speak up, we're going to speak out, and we're going to do a little rabble-rousing. And so the cultures are totally different. Now, I have the 1960s scheduled for April, so it's going to be a ways off to compare the two, obviously. But you do make a good point that the two decades are distinctly different.
You know, almost opposite.
Almost opposite.
But you say this is 60s aren't coming until April, so what are you going to do in February and March?
Well, in February, I have scheduled an interesting take on genealogy. And right now, I feel there's a huge hole in studying genealogy. Everybody wants to discover if they're related to Henry VIII, but that's only one piece of it. Documenting the family oral histories is a huge hole that a lot of people are missing, because grandma is in the home. Talk to grandma while she's alive. Find out what her life was like. Get her stories. See what it was like when she was a young girl. Find out what she and her sisters and her brothers did for fun. Talk to her about life on the farm. Talk to her about, you know, how the family worked together at that time or didn't work together, how hard life was, how easy life was, whether they were considered rich or poor, whether they lived in town or on the farm. There's so much information that is going to the grave with a lot of people, and I think that just studying the mere relationships between who you're related to leaves a huge hole in genealogy, and that you should really pay attention to documenting that family history because it goes away.
I'm a fan of social history, and when I started becoming aware of genealogy, I realized that it's genealogy that keeps social history alive, the lives of ordinary people. And of course, we can't. There are ways that people can reconstruct that for the more distant past, but we have a lot of resources to do it for right now.
Yes, and I certainly believe people should take advantage of that right now. You know, talk to your brothers, talk to your sisters, get them to write down their stories, because, you know, your sister may have an accident next week and her stories are gone. And it's tragic. It's very tragic. But I think writing these oral histories down is important for the next generation and the generation after that, because you're not doing it just for you. You're doing it for the future generations. So this information is preserved because there's no other way to do it other than to just take control and do it.
Now, so that is February. What's March?
March is called Charm School. I found some interesting information on manners in the 1900s, early 1900s. And I'm also going to incorporate what was learned in charm school in the mid-century, in the mid-20th century. And then we're going to fold in manners as they exist today and what they should exist today. And so I'm going to cut out a fair bit of time for discussion on this particular month's, and I'm waiting to see what happens. I think there's some topics that we can discuss, but I think some people have interesting opinions about what manners should and shouldn't happen at this point in time, and maybe have valid points to be made. The anniversary of the moon landing happened in June, but because the June event happens after the anniversary of the moon landing, in May, we're going to go over the discoveries that happened because of the moon landing. Now, we all know, if we're of a certain age, that we landed on the moon, and it was a fantastic event, and I do remember watching TV and watching it happen, and it was amazing. They brought back moon rocks, and they brought back samples, and it's all very amazing. And we know they went up there with the power of a calculator, a modern calculator. But there are a number of discoveries that happened because of the moon landing. And those have been brushed under the rug over time. And nobody realizes what discoveries were really made due to us going into space and landing on the moon. And I think it's just an interesting intellectual activity to say, oh, wow, we discovered that because we went up to the moon and took a look. You know, and so I think it's a kind of an interesting take on the moon landing because, you know, like I said, we all know what happened, but nobody knows the results.
Does the series end at the beginning of summer, or are you going to run through the summer?
No, in June we're going, tying in with the reading program with the library. They're doing music series. And in the month of June, we're going to do the history of musical instruments. And we're going to do a little bit of immersion therapy for the people that come. And they're going to get their hands on some musical instruments that they may not have had a chance to do in their life.
Kind of an instrument petting zoo, if you will.
So that's going to be in the library?
Yes.
Well, where do you have the space for these activities?
The library has a meeting room that we use for our special programs, obviously, but the community is also able to rent the room for meetings or family gatherings. We have people who have come, I think we had somebody on Thanksgiving do their family dinner in our meeting room. You know, it's $10 an hour, so it's not that bad, and we do have the option for community members to use that space when we're not open with just a key deposit, and we can close some doors that allow them to still use that. But it holds up to 100 people in chairs, but we are able to fit in some extra people when we have the little kiddos in the summer programs sitting on the floor.
Do you have a kitchen of any kind?
Yep, there's a little kitchenette in there. So there's a refrigerator, there's a sink, there's a coffee maker back there. There are some serving utensils and towels and things that people can use. I think there's even a microwave back there, so people are able to use it for food.
Have you had any people sign up for the Breaking the Ice yet, or do you just wait and see who shows up?
We don't have a registration for a lot of our programs, so we do kind of just see who shows up. It always varies, but it's fun to see who comes.
Have you ever done anything like this before?
In the time that I've been here, we've had some individual speakers come, individual presenters. We haven't had a series in the way that we are doing this one.
So is there anything else that you'd like people to know about this?
To me, it sounds like a great deal of fun, so come and join us.
Thank you.
This is KHOI Community Radio, and we've been talking about the series Breaking the Ice with Shauna Speer and Jean Vriestad at the Nevada Public Library, focusing on the first program, Look Back, the 1950s. Moving on to a different way to discover the 50s, we'll go to the Talent Factory in Nevada, where Richie Lee and the Fabulous 50s will be on stage Saturday, January 27th.
Well, this is Paul, your co-host, and this really dovetails with my life because Richie Valens and the Big Bopper and Buddy Holly went down in a plane up in Clear Lake on my 16th birthday, February 3rd, 1959. And I believe our talent coming up on the stage of the Talent Factory, Richie Lee is going to be performing Buddy Holly. So, Larry, are you there?
Yes, I am. Good morning.
Talk about great things from the 1950s. And I'm familiar with him because I've seen him on TV. Tell us a little bit about Richie Lee and his Buddy Holly thing.
Well, Richie is fabulously. He's been doing Buddy Holly since a very young age. He gets into the Buddy Holly mind. I mean, he does Buddy Holly, but he also does Richie Valens. He does Big Bopper. He does Ricky Nelson. And the music and his act are just fabulously authentic.
And this is really a look back at the 1950s. So, as you said, he goes beyond Buddy Holly to other very famous folks from that era. And tell us about when that show's coming off. I think it's January 27th, right?
It is, January 27th at the Talent Factory in Nevada, Iowa. The show starts at 7 o'clock, and our doors will open at 6. It is a former movie theater, so we've got wonderful seating. There's not a bad seat in the house. The Talent Factory's worked very hard to get good sound systems, lighting, and effects in there. So it's a concert on every level.
And so basically you're talking about, well, someone my age could really have a nostalgic trip back on the 27th, right?
Yeah, I'm clued. I don't know how old you are, but
I'm 75, by the way.
I'm 65. So yeah, I mean, it's music I grew up with, obviously. And the amazing thing is that young people are discovering the music. So a lot of our crowd is obviously going to be of our age group. But there are also younger people coming to this music now and experiencing just the joy that you get in the music and without the anger and the violence and everything you get, it seems, in today's music.
And there's melody involved. That's what I like about it. As an old guy, I'm going to hear melody. Well, not only do you have this concert coming up on the 27th, but you've booked some other things coming up on my birthday, February 3rd. What's happening that day?
We've got a group called Shy of a Dozen, which is an ISU a cappella group. And these guys are really fabulous. There are 11 of them. And they do an absolutely fabulous job of modern tunes and some older tunes that are all a cappella. And they're funny. They're relevant to today. And they're young college students for the most part.
I went online to try to get one of their songs. I got a Billy Joel song, The Longest Time. Which,
you did a great job on that.
Yeah, so it's the same kind of continuation of great tunes.
Absolutely. The week after that, we've got a Beatles tribute band coming in. So we've got music of the 60s and the Beatles. So we've got a lot of really great shows coming in.
So we're talking about January 27th, February 3rd, and February 10th. And it's all a look back, Larry, right?
Yes, it is. We found that tribute bands seem to be very popular right now. So we're doing a lot of tribute music. People can go to our website at iowatalentfactory.com, and they can see all the upcoming entertainers that we have coming in, as well as videos and sound bites of those entertainers so they can hear them and see them.
Well, thank you, Larry, from the Talent Factory. Coming up over in Nevada, a look back to the 50s, 60s, and the history of rock and roll. Big shows on the 27th, on the 3rd of February, and on the 10th of February. All at the Talent Factory. Larry, thanks for taking us back to the 50s, my time.
Thanks for having me today.
Very good. Thanks, Larry.
Take care.
Over the past several weeks, Pat Schlarbaum has made us aware of a series of water quality forums that started in Decorah, and then continued on to Cedar Rapids and then to Ames. Next Monday, January 22nd, at Drake University in Des Moines, there will be a fourth forum. Kevin Tekka spoke with Pat about this one.
Welcome to Local Talk, Kevin Tekka.
Thank you very much.
We're here to discuss a CAFO, Confinement Animal Feeding Operations, / Water Quality Forum, Monday, January 22nd, 2018, from 6 p.m. to 8:30 p.m. on the Drake University campus, Cartwright Hall, room 206. These are free. It is sponsored by the Drake Agriculture and Environmental Law Association. There have been three previous panel discussions in Decorah, Cedar Rapids, and Ames, and this is Kevin Tekka, who is a main coordinator, giving you some background information. What was your thinking when you invited these panelists to Decorah, Iowa?
Sure. Thanks, Pat. Well, I'm currently an attorney at the Shelter Blades Law Firm in Cedar Rapids. Prior to that, I was the U.S. attorney in the Northern District of Iowa. One of my top priorities was enforcing environmental laws, both civilly and criminally. I became aware that a clean water issue in Iowa, there's some 800 polluted waterways. 60% of the waterways that they've tested are polluted. So there's really two parts to that. There's the CAFO part and then the soil erosion. So I was aware that in northeast Iowa, there have been some sightings of CAFOs where the local folks really felt that it was inappropriate. In fact, the DNR director indicated that he felt that it shouldn't be allowed there, but felt like his hands were tied by the master matrix. So we put together a panel at Luther College in Decorah, and the purpose was to cover the issues legislatively, impact, and then some legislation that's facing the legislature this next session.
And you mentioned the master matrix. Apparently that's the governmental regulatory paperwork that allows a confinement animal feeding operation to site on the land.
The master matrix was created by the Iowa legislature back when CAFOs were kind of invented, and it was the purpose, at least the touted purpose, was so that the sightings would be in places appropriate. It's a scoring system that's supposed to evaluate the siting of permitted confinement feeding operations in Iowa. What's happened is that the counties have no real impact in this decision. So the matrix is on kind of automatic pilot. 97% of the CAFOs that have ever been submitted applications have been confirmed. So there's no local control, either from an environmental impact, either the smell, the stink, or the impact on waterways, or just the value of the land, and that some of these CAFOs have been put, you know, directly adjacent to where people live.
And I see that one of the panel members, Monty Marty, from Allamaquis County, what was his situation?
Well, one of the highlights of the three panel, his family farm in Village Creek in Allamaquis County, so the far northeast corner of Iowa, his parents sold a small section of their farm, and then an individual that wanted to put CAFOs came in. And so Marty really poignantly talks about the impact and why this isn't an environmentally sound decision. And that it's close to a trout stream, and it's also close to a spring. And so it's pretty clear that it's just not a question of if, it's when there's going to be an environmental disaster from those CAFOs up in Allamaquis County near Village Creek.
And go ahead and refresh us on the other panel members, please.
Well, we start out with David Johnson, a longtime state legislator who's an independent, former Republican senator, but now is with neither party, so he's pretty free to speak his mind, if you will. he was one of the co-authors some 15 years ago of the Master Matrix. So he has a really good perspective on what the thinking was, what the influencers were, and why it's not working now. He said he's learned a lot of lessons the hard way and really shares those. A man named Larry Stone, who's from Clayton County, an author and longtime Des Moines Register outdoor writer, he talks about he's been following very closely the Waltz Energy Facility in Bloody Run Creek in Clayton County, so just one county below Al McKee. Dr. Gene Tinker, who was an expert on CAFO, Mr. Matt Batrix, former DNR staff person. Steve Falk, who is an environmental policy specialist with the Environmental Law and Policy Center, and he gives a good overview of some of the legislation that's been proposed to fix the problems with the Master Matrix and beyond. And then Jess Marzur, who's an organizer with Iowa Citizens for Community Improvement, really gives a good overview of where things sit historically and then how people can be involved at the grassroots level if they care about this issue.
And I first heard about this forum through Larry Stone, who was on one of our earlier programs, and that was in Decorah. What did you take away from that first gathering?
Well, it's pretty clear by the turnout. We had some 120 or so people come, and they were all passionate about this issue. So I think there's a real groundswell around this issue in northeast Iowa, but throughout the state of Iowa. Some 21 counties now have passed some form of resolution asking the legislature to do a moratorium on the CAFO. In other words, hold it in place until we can look at it and fix it, bring some balance to it, allow more local control. And so that really came through loud and clear in the dialogue at the end of the panel, once they kind of set the stage and people had an opportunity to ask questions. And so it's clear people really care passionately about this issue.
And then a second panel in Cedar Rapids. How did that compare?
It was very similar, although we added a panelist, David Osterberg, who's a professor emeritus at the University of Iowa College of Public Health, who's done some evidence-based work along with Dr. Jim Merchant, who is the founder of the College of Public Health, on the public health impact on CAFOs. And so David talked about that. And then we also had Chris Peterson, who's a board member of the Iowa Farmers Union. And Chris really makes the strong point that he's been in farming his whole life. About 20 years ago, his traditional farming methods with no CAFOs was considered mainstream. Now he says he's considered a niche farmer, which shows you how the dynamics have changed. Just recently, the Iowa DNR, who's responsible for the licensing, discovered there's some 5,000 animal confinement facilities that they didn't even know existed, and their job is to keep track and make sure they're being done right. So this is a fast-developing issue. There's no balance. The matrix isn't being used the way it should be used, so it's an important issue for all Iowans.
Monday night, what are you hoping can complement?
Well, I think the speakers, yeah, really set the stage and really some of the fundamentals of the issue, so people that, you know, are interested in the issue can learn how this developed, where it stands, and where it might be going, and then also some of the key issues going forward. This is an issue that all the governor candidates should address, all the legislators should address, because when you have some 800 waterways that are polluted, that really shows you things are out of whack, out of balance, and the master matrix is not doing its job and needs to be fixed so there can be balance in the siting of these CAFOs and we can protect our environment.
Very good points all around. Is there anything else that hope can evolve here with a gathering of this prominence?
Well, it's a good chance, like I say, for people to, you know, just to understand the fundamentals of the issue. One other stat that just really is distressing is that there's been some 700 manure spills in our waterways over the last 10 years or so. And most of those have come from CAFO situations where there's lagoon pits collect the pig manure, and then they have to be transported. And unfortunately, too many times there's a spill, and too often those spills end up in our waterways, killing fish and then polluting the streams. You know, farmers care about the environment, but we need to have a better regulatory system to make sure that this doesn't happen as often as it does to protect our environment.
Very good. There are farmers on the panel. So
absolutely. Yeah, well, these are people that lifelong farmers that really care about the environment and talk about what can be done to make things better and bring more balance to this important issue.
Looking forward to seeing you then Monday evening, January 22nd, 2018, from 6 p.m. to 8:30 p.m. on the Drake University campus, Cartwright Hall, room 206. These are free. It is sponsored by the Drake Agriculture and Environmental Law Association. We hope you have a good turnout for you, Kevin.
Yeah, thanks for the chance to visit. Thank you.
You bet. Thank you, sir.
You have been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I've been your host, Susan Franzen, together with my co-host, Paul Wearson. Thank you for listening. Other voices you heard were Matt Patton, Mara McKay, Shauna Spear, Gene Freestadt, and Larry Sloan. Local Talk airs at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. here on KHOI at 89.1 FM. Remember that you can also hear us online at khoifm.org and find links to the guests and information you heard during the program. KHOI is streaming live online at khoifm.org.
Today's show was engineered by Jackie Norman. Our theme song, as always, is Backtracking by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. We'll be closing out today with The Longest Time, a Billy Joel hit, sung by Shy of a Dozen from Iowa State University, an a cappella group. Local Talk is a radio production workshop as well as a show, so if you would like to try your hand at reporting, we'll train you. Come and join the Local Talk team here at KHOI.
Let us know what you think. You can call us at 515-292-2878, email us at khoiradio@gmail.com, or go to the contact page of our website, khoifm.org. Remember, you, the listener, are what makes KHOI meaningful and possible. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.
So far.